This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers. They're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Ready for an awesome episode? Well, so are we. But you know what? Before we get to it, I got to tell you that members of Navy Federal Credit Union could earn more and save more. Bam! Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as our friends at Navy Federal do. Start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit. For example, you could open an Easy Start certificate for just $50. And then how many certificates do this? You can then add money at any time and watch your savings grow. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Membership required. Terms and conditions apply. Loan subject to approval.
Hey, this is Lou Mangiello from WDW Radio. And when I'm not at Walt Disney World or sharing my passion for Disney World or eating, I am stacking Benjamins.
Live from Joe's mom's basement, it's The Stacking Benjamin Show. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and how do you climb out of an endless financial abyss? Is there any wisdom that can help you turn the tide? Here to help us, from the Everyday Courage podcast, we welcome Jillian Johnsrud. And from LenPenzo.com, it's Daddy Warbucks. Only one person on this podcast is old enough to get that joke, so we just had to grab Len Penzo. Last but not least, it's the one, the only, Paula. Awesome. Plus, we'll welcome the head of a digital bank serving an underserved community. And they have a unique way of paying high-interest bonuses to savers. We'll get the skinny on Quantic Bank from Steve Schnall during today's Friday FinTech segment. Later, we'll magnify Nick's money, and I'll culture you with some Shakespeare-themed trivia. And speaking of Shakespeare, here comes a guy who's probably less Romeo and a little more King Lear court jester, Joe Saul Sehy.
And I'll take that as a compliment. He's usually the smart guy that tells the truth, right? And I'm sure Doug doesn't know that. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Friday. Let me be the first to welcome you. I'm Joe Saul Sehy, Average Joe Money on Twitter. And Mr. OG's not here today. So we're going to start off in a... Are we still calling it an undisclosed location, Paula? Are you in an undisclosed location? Or are you now in a disclosed location?
I will be in an undisclosed location. I will be in the ephemeral, ethereal of in-between lands.
I just don't know where we're at with this FBI witness protection thing that you got going on.
Don't know where we're at. That's exactly the point.
Ta-da! She's like, and it's working. So how are you doing this fine Friday?
I am excellent. I just had a sushi lunch because I'm fancy like that.
Of course. Yes.
Yes.
Well, we're going to... We're going to follow it up with Shakespeare, by the way. Sushi and Shakespeare today.
Sushi and Shakespeare. That is really good enunciation. Sushi and Shakespeare.
Yes.
With
a side of systemic poverty. Yeah. Not a laughing matter there. But a guy who keeps us laughing on this show, deep under Los Angeles in his bunker, Mr. Len Penzo.
Yes, the worst kept secret in America is the location of my bunker. Unlike Paula, who's in an undisclosed, mine's completely disclosed and terrible, terrible. Everybody knows where I'm at.
Do you actually have, does like the UPS person knock on your manhole cover to bring you stuff, bring you your new MREs?
No, they actually, they have to ring in and, because there's mines and there's a minefield between the entrance to the bunker and the property line. And they know that. So they keep their distance, Joe.
They leave it a healthy, like...
They leave it right there, right at the property line. Perfect. Yes, that's right.
Fantastic. Yeah. And the woman who's wondering what she's doing on this property today is like, what the heck's going on? The woman behind the Everyday Courage podcast, she's finally here. It's about time. Jillian Johnsrud joins us. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, welcome to this party. And for the three people that don't know about your awesome podcast, tell us what it's about.
The idea behind Everyday Courage is that most progress in life requires a little bit of courage, but not like huge heroic courage, just like the ordinary courage of, you know, trying to apologize, putting yourself in uncomfortable situations, that normal growth. So we chat about that in the terms of money and personal growth, work, all those categories.
Yeah, it's like the intersection of all three of those, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah, good times. Well, I'm glad you're with us today. We're going to have a great time. You told us ahead of time you were trying to explain the Stacking Benjamin show to your husband.
Yeah. And I described it, take this as a compliment if you can, a little bit like Animaniacs. If you guys remember that show, like from the 90s, it has a little bit of that fun vibe to me. And he was like, oh, great. So it's like this really fun podcast. And I was like, yeah, we're talking about poverty. So I've been working all morning on how to bring my Animaniac spin to poverty. Not sure if I'm going to get there, but we'll see.
The bar is high, Jillian. And I'm wondering, because I'm watching Paula on the shortwave radio, like smiling and nodding. There's no way in hell you know what Animaniacs are.
I do know what Animaniacs are.
Who are you?
You know, because Tiny Toons was one of my favorite cartoons as a kid with Babs and Buster Bunny.
It is a Freaky Friday here on the show. We got Jillian here. We got Paula here. I think it's Paula. We got Led here. We're going to have a very, very rare for this show, serious discussion about poverty and climbing out of the hole. So let's get started. Normally, our posts that we focus on, if you're new to the show, come from popular financial bloggers, and we get inspiration for our conversations from them. Today, we had inspiration from Reddit, which we don't do very often, but this discussion on Reddit began with a rant, and the headline is what caught our team's attention, which was this: does anybody else find being poor absolutely exhausting? And the person writes back again for another rant. I feel like I can't go one day without thinking about being poor. I'm constantly planning and budgeting and thinking of ways to make money. When I'm not working, I'm calling places to attempt to get extensions on my bills. I'm doing surveys and scanning receipts several times a week for pocket change. I'm just tired, physically and mentally. I'm tired. I couldn't imagine what a small hand up could do for me. Like if I could just get ahead for a little bit, I'd be fine. ... And I thought, what a great place to start a conversation. It certainly started one on Reddit. There were 632 responses to this one particular thing, but this hit me hard because, and by the way, just a spoiler alert, we're not going to solve poverty in the next 20 minutes because there's no easy solution. And I feel like sometimes people think there's a very easy solution to poverty, and yet it's so systemic, not just around the United States, but around the world, that clearly there aren't easy solutions. But Jillian, I know a little bit about your story. I won't say I'm the Jillian expert, but you've experienced poverty in your life. Did this resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. It is exhausting. And, you know, I think this year has actually been a helpful insight, because before there wasn't many things that we could say, yeah, it's like going through this. But to some degree, I think it's like going through 2020, in that between the pandemic and just all of the things that were happening in our country, more people got to experience this, just this mental and emotional bandwidth suck of feeling drained, of not being able to focus, of just being distracted. For me, it was maybe 20% of what it was like growing up, but it's still a taste of that feeling overwhelmed all the time.
Were there days when you just didn't want to get out of bed?
This year or growing up?
Well, let's talk about growing up. Let's talk about the poverty part. The answer for me the last year was yes. Yes, there were days, but growing up.
The thing with some kinds of poverty is you're so close to the edge that you run on like cortisol and adrenaline and fear all the time. Mm. I would say sleeping well is a little bit harder than getting up because you're hypervigilant, because you have to be, because everything feels risky and dangerous. So it's more of a hypervigilance is kind of how I experienced it.
Lenna, have you ever experienced poverty?
Poverty, no, because when I think of poverty, to me, that's what is it in terms of the United States? I think the United States considers what 12,000 or 15,000 a year, something under that, is you're impoverished. No, I will say this though, and I can't imagine, but when I was growing up, my parents were really struggling. We weren't impoverished, but there were days when, you know, they used to put those signs out, like if you don't pay your water bill, and they would come and they would post a sign in your front yard. I mean, so everybody could see it. You know, your water bill is 20 or 30 days past due. And if you don't pay it in the next 3 days, you know, we're shutting off your water. I don't know if they still do that, but they used to do that back then. They'd post the sign right in our front yard.
Just shame you in front of the neighborhood.
I remember that. Yeah, I was ashamed. And it wasn't my parents' fault. It was just, they didn't have the money at times and they were short. And there were times when I remember my mom and dad sitting at the kitchen table saying, you know, we only have $100 for groceries, you know, and it's got to last for 2 weeks. And this is way back when, which, you know, that still went further, but my mom was cutting every coupon she possibly could. And it was scary. I mean, as a child, I was kind of scared. You know, going, gosh, are we gonna have enough food to eat? But no, we weren't impoverished in that way, but things were very tight for a long time.
That's a secondary piece we're not gonna get to is which you hear that story a lot of not scaring children in the family. I mean, if you're really wondering where your next meal is gonna come from, not scaring the kids. Paula, to move this conversation forward, I want to ask you a question just about the financial space, because as I went looking for serious articles on poverty and thought pieces on poverty, I got two things. One were pieces that I would say said that it's systemic, it's complex. Like we said, we're not going to solve it today. But then there was the other side, which is stop being so lazy, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. You can do this. You can be the person that breaks a cycle, change your mindset, and you're going to be much better. Why do so many people, and even when we talk about this, like in our Facebook group, sometimes we have people that talk about poverty that way. Why do we want to convince ourselves that this is just a easy thing to solve? We can just get up and go.
Well, what I think is a shame about the way that that's cast as an either or, right? Like that's cast as two sides that are in opposition to one another. And you either believe A or you believe B, you know, like they're two different parties or like they're two different sports teams. When the comprehensive picture is that it is absolutely true that there are systemic, deeply entrenched issues, intersecting issues that are involved in poverty. And yet, if our response is to say, therefore, you have no power, therefore, there's nothing you can do, then what we do is we disempower people who are already living in poverty. And what kind of humans would we be if we were to send a message that disempowered the people who are already at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder? And so I think it's important to send a message of personal responsibility insofar as it is both sent and received as a message of empowerment rather than a message of shame.
I love that. A gentleman has been on the show twice. John Hope Bryant has a very similar discussion. He talks about how the system is built against you, but that's not a reason to not try. That's a reason to try harder, right? To know that every day it's going to be a difficult climb, but that means you climb harder.
Right. I like the phrase, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility.
Oh, that's very good. So Jillian, let's take this in two ways. Number one, for yourself, for this person here, they're so tired being in poverty. What would you tell them?
It is tricky because you're already so tired, and it can be discouraging because your progress on the front end is going to be slow. You just don't have that compound interest working for you. And the reality is, if 95% of your bandwidth is used up, you're only going to be working with 5%, which is kind of the short end of the stick, but you just have to do the very best you can with that 5%. Like, the first step we all have to have is hope. It's so easy to be hopeless and it's so easy to give up. And so you have to kind of develop a perspective that's like, yeah, this is going to take a long time and this is going to be really hard, but I'm going to do everything that I can do, everything that I have to do to make it at least a little bit better. Because as it gets a little bit better, as you have like $1,000 emergency fund, it frees up a little bit more mental, emotional bandwidth. As like things get paid down, you have a little bit of margin. You'll have more bandwidth to do more things down the road. It's just slow going. And I think about like, what's the price of admission? And it's high. And sometimes it's unfair, but it's kind of finding that gumption to be like, okay, well, this is the cost, I guess. Guess they better get going.
I love that perspective, it's a nice longer term perspective, right? That you have to build that foundation. But I remember being in this spot. I was searching in my very beat up minivan for a couple quarters that I could put in a gas tank because I'd run out of gas. And I, number one, couldn't figure out how to get home. And then number two, I also, once I got home, I had no idea how I was getting to work the next day because I was just clean out of money and out of resources. But what is it? I mean, does that perspective come with education? Is it surround sound? Is it, what is it? How do you start to get a longer term view where you can say, well, I'm going to go ahead and be okay with these little incremental improvements?
For me, it was books from the library. I took that little bit of bandwidth and I started reading. And I started reading a book a week. And that gave me access to the second thing that I think is so powerful. And that's relationships. Like, you need people who are out of this that you're in, that can offer that perspective, that can offer that encouragement. But I didn't have access to those relationships, but books gave me that. I could read a book and then I had something to talk about with people who were in very different life situations than I was.
That's powerful. Len, for you, surrounding yourself with the right people, how important has that been to your success?
It's been very important. Absolutely. You always want to have the right people around. But I think one of the big things you need to do is, going back to the question you asked Jillian, was, I think, self-discipline. You've got to have discipline. And none more so when you are down and out and just things are desperate. You have got to take control of your life and look inward and say, I'm going to do this no matter what. And so set some small goals, start small, make them achievable, and modest as they may be, you might not pull you out of poverty within 6 months or 3 months. Maybe it's going to take a year, but have that goal, work towards it, and then leverage whoever you can. And now we'll get back to the relationships. Everybody you know, share those goals with people you know. Anybody that can help you. I don't care if you're having trouble getting a job. Write down those goals. Go ahead when you're looking for a job and you're going out and you're talking to a potential employer. I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's a McDonald's or wherever you're going to go to get started. You say where you're at. These are your goals. This is what you want to do. And just start working towards those goals. And just, you've got to do it yourself. You have to dig deep. You have to. That's because if nobody's going to help. I know the government has assistance, but in the end, it's up to you. You have to do it yourself, no matter how hard it is.
And it gets very hard, Len, when you're being beaten every day. Like, every day you're getting beaten over and over and over and over and over.
I can totally. Yeah, it's got to be hopeless for people to feel hopeless. But once you feel hopeless, you're not going to get out of that. You're going to spiral down. You've got to fight that. Want to say it's hopeless, because like I said, you have to do it yourself and you have to depend on you.
you know, with not just what Len just said, Paula, but also what Jillian said earlier, surrounding yourself with the right thoughts and the right people and having the self-discipline also means maybe cutting some of the people that are around you, mm-hmm. some of the relationships that you have. How do you start off on that journey?
Well, I think the most important cuts that you make are the people who tell you that it's impossible. They are the people who plant doubts, because those doubts will hold you back. If you are setting an ambitious goal to break the cycle, you know, which is one of the hardest things that a person can do, you need to surround yourself with people who are like, yes, you can break the cycle. Yes, you can beat the odds. Yes, you can be the outlier. And if you are surrounded by people who have already given up and they want you to give up alongside them so that they can feel better about their own decision to give up, like crabs in a bucket, they're just trying to pull you back down. Those are definitely the relationships you've got to cut. And that doesn't just apply, you know, to people in poverty. I mean, I think that also applies to people in the middle class who are trying to ascend into the upper middle class. That's also a hard rung on the ladder to traverse. And there are a lot of people who are going to say, like, you can't do it.
I so badly, while you were talking, wanted to interrupt and say, I really doubt that, Paula. And I held back, but not completely. Yes. Jillian, when you were telling people that you had to disengage with them, did you say you're a crab in my bucket? You're dragging me down?
No, but as a kid, you don't really have a ton of choices of who your social circle is. And I grew up in a really small town. And especially as a kid, I don't know if people had a very high opinion of me when I was little, because I was dyslexic. And in grade school, I just did not seem very bright. I couldn't read. I couldn't do math. I couldn't write. I had extreme social anxiety. So I was shy as all get out. And so that first person for me was Oprah.
Oh, wow.
Every day I would come home from school and I would grab a Pop-Tart and I would sit in front of the TV and Auntie Oprah would show up. And she was the one who gave me that message. She would introduce me to all these cool people. She would bring people around the house and say, have you met this person who wrote this book? Have you heard this person's story? And it kind of created this buffer of maybe more is possible than what everyone around me is saying, what everyone else's opinion of me is. She had unwavering belief in me, just like a good auntie should.
That's super cool. I think that's awesome. Just by, once again, just like the library, reaching out and finding this positive role model. Let's get tactical here for a second, guys, because there are things that people need to know. Jillian earlier talked about the foundation, right? That there are some basic things that you need to build. In fact, I'm on a piece right now at self.inc talking about educating yourself on basic financial literacy, how credit works and how to build credit responsibly, your options when it comes to financial products and institutions. Cause you see people, of course, and there's a special place in hell for these people, but we always report on people that are in poverty who are getting just completely screwed and cheated out of the little bit of money they have by some financial institutions. And then your rights when it comes to banking and financial products. But Len, tactically, where do you start on that foundation if you're trying to build your ladder out?
Well, let's go to the old pay yourself first, right? So before those creditors, don't pay those creditors a dime. You keep that money for you and you build up your savings, because you know what? You're never going to get out of that hole. You're never going to get out of the hole. I think that's a number one.
I will second that. At that time of life when I was searching for those quarters, I had to let the phone go ahead and ring. I had to not talk to my creditors anymore. I had to let it go. And by the way, there was so much shame. I felt so much shame about that I couldn't do anything. But my mentors taught me that without that emergency fund, I was going nowhere. And if I was ever going to pay people back, I had to get that. Like this person says in the Reddit piece, I had to have just one day where crap didn't happen that just completely sucked. Paula, what else do you think somebody should do tactically to begin the foundation?
I would say watch, track, and monitor every single penny. For people who have that buffer, for people who are middle class, I've often recommended what I call the anti-budget, which is sort of a more intuitive sense of budgeting. But when you're in poverty or near poverty, when you have a very low income, that's the time to be monitoring every single penny and be very meticulous about that. Very granular.
Is that kind of sounds like the dentist to me, Paula. Like I had a client when I was a financial planner who told me, he's like, Joe, this is like going to the dentist. Like I hate going, but once I leave your office, I feel so much happier. I feel so great. And he goes, the dentist is the same way. I don't want to go, but I leave. And I'm like, man, that was great. And I'm so glad I did. Tracking every penny sounds exactly like that.
Yeah. To me, I mean, anyway. It's work, but it's also kind of liberating in that sense, because it's work, but it's the work of figuring it out, so that it's kind of like going to the gym. It's like effort when you're there, but then afterwards you feel really good.
Yes. I love working out when I'm done. Agreed.
Yeah. you love having had worked out.
Yes. And let's end this discussion where we're just getting the first layer of poverty. Jillian, where would you tell people to start besides Oprah?
Yeah, I would definitely watch Oprah. If you don't have a library, I grew up in a small town, so we didn't have a library. I started with Oprah. You know, that very first step for me was I created an emergency fund as a kid for my family.
Wow.
Because I was constantly scared. I was scared that we wouldn't have enough money for food. I was scared that the water would be turned off. You know, I was scared we wouldn't have gas in the car. And so I saved up birthday presents, Christmas presents. I got a job as quick as I could and had at least a couple $100. And it saved our bacon a few times to just be able to, like, sometimes you just need that little buffer. And then it frees up some of that mental and emotional bandwidth so you can focus on the next things. And then the next step for us, when me and my husband got married, we didn't make much that first year, like 12,000. We committed to saving half. And the easiest trick to do that is to figure out who in your community is making less money than you are. And how are they pulling it off? And that can kind of, the rubber hits the road sometimes. Okay, yeah, if I made, you know, 20% less, this is the things I might have to give up. But giving those up, even in the short term, is going to create some of that margin. It's going to give you the creativity and the motivation to keep going.
This episode is sponsored by State Farm. You, a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Well, look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers, they're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. Well, if you're new to the show, next up is our Friday FinTech segment where we explore along with you a cool idea that we found in FinTech land. And this is a bank that has been around for quite a while, serving, as we've been talking about today, lots of underserved people, but they also have a really unique high interest savings program for people that want to put deposits into the bank, and they pay you in, wait for it, Bitcoin. What's that all about? We're about to find out. But before we do that, Jillian, while you were talking earlier about making sure that your dad had gas in the car, in our car, we always want to make sure my dad didn't have gas in the car, which would happen whenever we had ice cream, but that's a whole different thing. But anyway, sorry for that, everybody. Let's talk to Steve Schnall from Quantic Bank. And coming down the stairs to the basement, it's our new friend from Quantic Bank, Steve Schnall. How are you, man?
I'm doing great, Joe. How about yourself? Happy to be here in the basement with you.
Well, I'm so happy that you could join us. Mom is all excited because of some of the things that you guys do that I'd frankly never heard of before. Tell us, though, let's start off with the origin story. I'd love to hear about how fintech founders get their start. Tell me about you and about Quantic. How did it come to be?
Sure. Well, I spent most of my career in mortgage finance and after the last credit crisis, sort of swore out of finance for a while. But when I saw hundreds and ultimately probably more than 1,000 banks failed, you know, going into 2009 and 10 and 11, we saw an opportunity. There were a lot of consumers being disintermediated and left out of banking, both on the lending side and on the depository side. So we went out and tried to find a tiny little beat up bank that we could afford to buy and then repurpose to become ultimately a consumer friendly digital bank. And that was 2010. And here we are 12 years later, and we've brought that vision to reality.
Where do you think banks were getting it wrong? You say that people were disenfranchised. Where were banks really messing up?
There are two distinct sides to what we do. There's Quantic, the lender on the mortgage side, and then there's Quantic, the depository. So on the lending side, after the last credit crisis, and everybody remembers what happened prior to that, there were all these high loan to value, no doc loans, and the world blew up because banks and lenders were being reckless. But what happened as a result of that is there were a lot of credit worthy people who weren't able to obtain mortgages anymore. And so we saw an opportunity to step into that void and become a niche lender where we can serve small business owners, low income households, seniors, people who had difficult to document income, people who simply couldn't get a mortgage, but frankly deserved one. So Quantic is unique in that it's a CDFI, which is a U.S. Department of Treasury designated community development financial institution, because we're mission oriented. And our mission as a lender is to lend to underbanked households, low income people, people in low income census tracts. But that includes small business owners who might have resources, but might show low income because COVID, you know, decimated their P&L, or because they're gig economy workers and don't make their money and document their income the traditional way. So we built a lending structure where we can make mortgage loans to people who don't fit the box, who don't meet the big bank, Wells Fargo's and Citibank's, you know, pay stub W-2 tax return, debt to income ratio qualify. We look for people who have a story to tell, and we make our lending decisions based upon the totality of someone's circumstances. If you could make a meaningful down payment and have good credit, we're not so concerned with what appears on your tax returns. And so that's really how we serve people on the lending side.
That was actually my follow-up question, Steve, was, are there different documents you look for? Are there different areas you look at? It sounds like credit score for the individual is huge.
We did a deep dive into historical data, and what we learned was, and it wasn't surprising, even through the last, you know, economic blow up, people who had significant equity in their property and good credit, regardless of documentation type, no doc, full doc, if you had equity and good credit, those loans performed, those people had the ability to pay. So our thesis is, if you've got skin in the game and a historical track record of paying your bills on time, then we'll base our lending decision primarily on that. And in fact, in some cases, we don't even ask for tax returns at all, or pay stubs or W-2s. If you're putting down 20% or more and you have great credit, we'll be able to make a loan based upon that. And we're unique in that respect because under the new Dodd-Frank legislation, there's actually a law that requires people buying a home to provide income documentation. But as a community development financial institution, we're exempt from that regulation, which enables us to service people that need it most.
Boy, you and your team then, Steve, must hear stories all the time about people that are just caught. I mean, on their end, they feel like they're doing all the right things, but according to conventional loan and lending standards, they can't get lending.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so we that business is growing. We will probably make $1 billion worth of home loans to people who meet those circumstances, either those in low income neighborhoods or those who don't have a significant amount of income to document on their tax returns.
A lot of lenders last year got headlines that, you know, figuratively stretch not just around the corner, but way down the block. And I heard all kinds of stories. We reported on lots of stories of people that would want to refinance something and it would take 2 months to get that done. Are you still seeing lines that long, or has the line kind of shortened recently?
The line's long, but we've staffed up to handle the volume. So we're still turning out approvals and closings very, very quickly. Idea being, service the customer or somebody else will.
I would imagine with your online presence too, you're able to service things faster, because it seems like with your digital presence, it makes things move.
Yeah. So the digital story is really the other side of the business.
Oh, let's go there.
And that's a really cool part of the story. So when we started this bank, the idea was consumers didn't need branches to go to anymore, and that everybody's got a mobile bank in their pocket. Everybody's got online banking. So our theory was, if we didn't spend a ton of money building out brick and mortar branches, we can use those savings to be able to pay people more money for their deposits online. So as a digital bank, the value proposition of Quantic is very straightforward. We value your deposit. We use your deposits to make those loans we were talking about. And so we need those deposits to put people in homes. And so we'll pay you for those deposits more than other banks will pay. And a great example is we have a high interest checking account, which pays up to 1% interest on a checking account. Wow. And while 1% is not a big number compared to every other bank in the country, it's huge.
I would say it's a big number right now.
Yeah, most banks on a checking account pay zero.
Right.
And so what we do, how do we pay you 1%? It's a partnership with the customer. We require that you use your debit card at least 10 times a month. And because when you use your debit card, which is something you do every day anyway, whether you're buying a Starbucks or paying for Netflix or what have you, when you use our debit card, we get paid interchange. So we basically just take that interchange and we pay it back to you in the form of a high interest rate. So that's one of the products. Another product we came up with, which we're really excited about, is our Bitcoin rewards checking product.
This is the one that mom couldn't stop talking about, by the way.
Yeah, we were the first bank in the country to come out with a Bitcoin rewards debit card. And once again, the theory here is use our debit card and we take the interchange that we earn and we pay it back to you in the form of Bitcoin. So every time you make a qualifying purchase, which is virtually everything other than like peer-to-peer payments, we pay you back 1.5% of the amount of the purchase in the form of Bitcoin. So unlike other reward programs, you know, membership miles or airline miles, these rewards can actually appreciate. And so for people who started using our Bitcoin rewards program a few months ago when we launched it, the value of those rewards have already doubled. And we believe in Bitcoin. We believe it's a great store of wealth and wealth builder. And so we're just excited to enable our customers to get access to Bitcoin without having to spend their own money on it and buy it, without having to take any risk. Use your debit card, bank with us, we pay you Bitcoin.
I have so many questions about that. But as you probably know, Steve, our audience is divided into two types of people. People that know Bitcoin intimately, it's almost like CrossFit, right? They know, all you got to do is ask them one question about Bitcoin, and then you're in a 45-minute conversation about how CrossFit or Bitcoin works. Okay. Or on the other side, they don't know anything about it, but they've heard about digital wallets, and we've done stories about people losing their Bitcoin. Is there anything people need to set up on their end if they're paid in Bitcoin by you?
No, we make it really easy. Open a checking account with us. It takes 3 minutes online, and we automatically then open up an account with you at our partner firm, which is called NYDIG. And NYDIG is, I believe, the best in class Bitcoin custodian in the world, because unlike other exchanges, NYDIG keeps our customers' Bitcoin in what's called cold storage off the internet. So it can't be hacked. It can't be stolen. So it's simple. Open your checking account, start using your debit card, and all of a sudden you're going to start getting statements showing that you've earned Bitcoin, and you don't have to do anything else. You don't have to understand it. You just get Bitcoin and you let it accumulate.
Who's the best customer for Quantic on this side, on the savings side?
Anyone and everyone who just wants to have a really nice, seamless checking and banking experience, and B, people who want to earn high interest rates on their money or want free Bitcoin. So it's a kind of a no-brainer.
It is very simple. And are there any, you know, one thing you and I talked about before we hit record here was the big banks, lots of hidden fees all over the place. Tell me about fee structure, working with Quantic Bank, anything that we should watch out for?
There's no fees. In fact, we have a network of over 100,000 ATMs, which our customers can use with surcharge free. We don't charge anything for the checking account. We don't charge anything to custody the Bitcoin. The only fee you'll pay is if you want to liquidate your Bitcoin, you'll pay a fee associated with that. But that's customary with selling any Bitcoin anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's even to us. That's to the partner.
And then to get to Quantic, is it an app at the App Store, or is it do I go on the web? How do I get there?
You can go to quantic.com and open the account there. And you can also download our mobile app at the App Store.
And it's interesting. I was looking at the app before we started talking, and it seems like a very intuitive interface, very clean, incredibly clean, like super easy to use. You guys spent a lot of time on usability.
It's actually clean and easy and simple. It doesn't have, we're not building budgeting tools or any of those. It's just, this is a basic, simple to use checking account.
Yeah. There's not 800 options on it. Yeah.
Real easy.
Yeah.
You can pay bills, you can transfer money, you have Zelle peer-to-peer payments, and of course you can earn Bitcoin or high interest.
And if people want more, as Steve said, is quantic.com. We'll have a link in our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. Steve, thanks a ton for sharing with us about Quantic. Such an interesting story you guys have, and I'm glad we were able to shine a spotlight on it.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the... Oh, hey there, trivia fans. You just caught me being my normal, cultured self. You know, with the Stacking Benjamins hitting the big stage on Westwood One, I think it makes sense to celebrate the more sophisticated holidays vis-a-vis today's Talk Like Shakespeare Day. Gather on the edge of your seats, young children, to hear what doth Chef Izeth cooking up. But before I do, let's get to today's trivia question. You know, at least if you're cultured, like I am trying to be by reading these facts off Google for you, that William Shakespeare dude, fellow, made most of his money at the Globe Theater in England. You know, with plays and probably action movies and maybe performing some concerts and stuff that just totally rocked, going like, you know, the roofeth Estan Fuego, we shall need no aqua. I'm sure it went like that. But hey, speaking of burning, today's question is, what year did the Globe Theater first burn down? I'll be back with the answer faster than you can make a snack run during the intermission.
Oh, Doug, I don't know. Hey, if you're brand new to the show, we have a year-long competition on our Friday roundtables where our three main contributors, Len, Paula, and OG, and today, Jillian, you are playing the part of OG, and we're keeping track all year long. We have a tie at the top. Len has 6, OG has 6, and Paula, as she always is this time of year, very, very naturally settled in with 3. So just holding back. And then, as we know, in the fall, she's going to make a mad rush. Happens all the time. But that means that Len's going to set the pace as our 2-time champ. OG will go second. And that means, Jillian, you go second. And then Paula gets to go third. So Globe Theater, my friend, Mr. Penzo, what year did burn down?
I have no clue. I don't know anything about this. I don't know what the Globe Theater is.
After your history a couple of weeks ago with the Civil War.
I know. This is a total blind. I can't even tell you exactly when Shakespeare was around.
5-10 years ago?
Yeah, right. This is embarrassing. I'm going to say probably this theater's probably was around. If it was around in Shakespeare's day, which I'm not even sure when it was, and it probably burned down way before then. Apparently, it's burned down many times. I'm going to say 1692.
1692. Jillian?
I also don't know. Although I've been there and I've seen a play, so it might be somewhere in my brain, but I'm not accessing it. I'm going to go with 1822.
1822. A lot of room between those two guesses, Paula.
Ooh. All right. So do I think it was before, after, or somewhere in the middle? I'm going to guess before, so I will guess 1691.
1691.
Capture the downside, or the before times.
Throws a Chelsea Brennan at Len's downside. All right.
Well, that's good, because that means I was probably close to being in the ballpark, right, Paula? You probably have a better idea of this than me.
I really don't. No, I think, I think that Shakespeare was alive in the 1500s.
Oh, geez. Well, I really screwed up.
But I don't actually know that for sure.
But it's funny. Jillian's the one person that's been there, and you just completely discounted her.
Actually, actually, yeah. Well, I actually didn't know where the Globe Theater was. When Jillian said that she'd been there, I was like, oh, then I'm assuming that this must be in England.
I went for Chautauqua. They took us to a gender reversal of Taming of the Shrew.
Was it fun?
It was very fun.
Yeah, cool place. Describe the place. What was it like?
It was a theater. It was rebuilt.
Right. Did they sell popcorn for $16.95?
No. I did buy some very expensive ice cream, though.
That's where they get you. That's where they get you. All right. We'd love to tell you which one of you three is closest, but we don't do it that way. We'll be right back.
Stackers, controlling your money on a day-to-day basis comes down to two things. Number one, great communication, either with yourself or with a partner. And by great communication, what do I mean? I mean, sitting down with your app of choice and putting together your strategy based on what you spent the week before. It's super easy. A 20-minute meeting a week. You look through your expenses and then you plot out what are you going to do next week. And you know what? That might seem little, but the big things stem from that. And if you have an app that keeps that in front of you, that helps make it even easier. And the app Cheryl and I use is Monarch Money. We've been using it now for about a year. As you may know, I've used lots of different solutions, and this is by far the one I've stuck with the longest. It helps Cheryl and I collaborate. We can talk about our financial goals. For us, it's travel. We're also adding to our house. We have a goal in a few years to really work on our lawn as well and just make it a pretty place to live. But the travel piece, as you know, if you've listened to me for any amount of time, that's a big one. And what's cool is I can put our financial independence goals and our journey up right next to our budget, because everything at Monarch is very intuitive. It is very customizable. So what the heck is Monarch? You're sitting there wondering to yourself, aren't you? Person I just made up. Yes. Let me tell you what it is. It's an all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you comprehensive view of all your accounts, your investments, your transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track your progress toward your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, Stackers, because you're a stacker, you're going to get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Benjamins. Got to have the /Benjamins to get the extended 30-day free trial so you can see that you'll like it as much as I do. How does it work? Well, it's very intuitive. It has a simple, intuitive design that makes it easy to set up, customize, and use. You can collaborate with your partner, family, or your financial advisor. What's cool is you can invite all these people to your account at no extra cost, so you can collaborate and everybody gets their own login info and everybody gets a joint view of your finances. And as I mentioned earlier, it's customizable, and best yet, it's ad-free privacy you can trust. No ads. You're not being marketed. When I had other apps that were free, I got marketed all the time. Well, not only do they not do that, they also don't sell your data to third parties. After trying out Monarch for myself and using it for about a year now, on a daily basis, I totally get why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, because you're a stacker, you're going to get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Benjamins. That's Monarch Money, monarchmoney.com/Benjamins for your extended 30-day free trial.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a
likelihood. So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Len, you set the stage with 1692. You're shaking your head.
Joe, I have no freaking clue on this. None.
Jillian, you said 1822. That it must look like a theater out of the 1800s if you've been there. She's looking at me like, no. Paula, feeling confident?
I guess so. I mean, I don't know. I figured the nature of the question asked, when was the first time it burned down, implying that it burned down multiple times. So I figured it was just a safer bet to err on the side of the before times.
Well, it's a safe bet that Doug doesn't know, but he's looked it up. So let's see what the answer is. all of you regal dames and damsels who stacketh the Benjamins. I've been working on some poetry for you, a penny for your thoughts. To be a great podcast about money, or not to be a great podcast about money? That is the question, indeed. All right. I'm just going to come out and say it. All this talk like Shakespeare holiday bullshit really sucks. I mean, it just fucking sucks. How would Shakespeare complain? This doth sucketh? I don't even care, you know? I'm totally over it. Let's get back to today's trivia before I loseth my temper. The question was, since Shakespeare made most of his money at the Globe Theater in England, what year did his paycheck, the Globe Theater, burn down? According to modern estimates, Shakespeare earned what was on par with other famous stars at the time. So when the Globe Theater burned down in 1613, that couldn't have been good for his wallet. I don't know, maybe if he talketh like a human, fans wouldn't have been angry enough to burn it down. What, too soon? All right, I had enough of this Shakespeare dude. See ya!
Hey, I was in the right century.
Yeah, thanks for anchoring that for me, Len.
Hey, Doug, I bite my thumb at you, sir. I do remember that from English.
I don't remember that at all. I have no idea. Oh, what does that mean?
I can't even not talk about it.
Oh, yeah, I bite my thumb at you. I remember that.
Bite my thumb at you, sir. It's an insult.
It's like I stick my middle finger up at you. I bite my thumb at you.
That's I can't even remember what Shakespeare play that was, but I do remember that.
Yeah.
But there was one. Len's going to be bragging about that for the next 4 days that he remembered a Shakespeare line.
Len, when you said that you remembered that from English, it immediately made me think of a pair of boxer shorts with Homer Simpson on it that I once saw, where Homer is quoted as saying...
Did you see my underwear? I was going to say...
Well, Homer's quoted as saying, English? Why should I study English? I'm never going to England.
Yeah.
Hey, before Paula starts gloating too much about winning, finally, Paula!
Finally, now four wins.
Let's take out the magnifying glass and help somebody do better with their money. Today's hotline call comes to us courtesy of MagnifyMoney.com. Jillian, when you go to StackyBenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney, you know what you find?
No.
That is like 0487 guests, I think. It's amazing. You'll find all those financial products used every day at your brick and mortar bank. Nowhere near the best in class because over 92% of all the stuff online available at MagnifyMoney.com, like savings accounts all ranked, checking accounts all ranked. In fact, I found my Ally Bank high interest savings account at Magnify Money. StackingBenjamins.com/MagnifyMoney. And today we're going to help Nick magnify his money. Say hi, Nick.
Hey, Joe, OG. Got a question for you. Quick and easy, down and dirty. Fidelity reached out. I have a HSA through them. They have a credit card that earns 2% cash back that can be reinvested into a HSA 529 brokerage. So my question comes in is with the utilization rate. I know that people say 30% is where you want to be, below 30%, so it doesn't negatively affect your credit. While talking it over with some people, they threw out things like you could, if you're going to pay cash for a vehicle, you could put it on your credit card and then pay it off. My question is when does this 30% come into effect? Is this like every day? As soon as you hit that 30% threshold, you're above that and it negatively affects? Or is it once the statement period closes, maybe? Hope that makes sense. I appreciate it. Probably not going to help, but, I tried.
I love the vote of confidence. Remember Paula, when you were talking about how you should hang around people that are confident about you and your ability,
right? Exactly.
We can't hang out with Nick because that guy doubts us already. Nick, we're going to pull through for you, man. Let's talk a little bit of credit. Jillian, any thoughts for him?
Well, I think it's kind of two separate issues between is this 2% card a good deal and something worth pursuing? And then how much should you, you know, put on your credit cards? So I think kind of tackling both of those separately.
Yeah. So let's do that. Do you like the 2% deal?
if you really have a hard time saving, it's a great forced saving option to have that 2% go towards one of these accounts. But there's a lot of other cards that are at 2% or 1.5%, or I have a Costco card that's a little bit higher for gas. You know, my Amazon card's 5%, my Lowe's card's 5%. So it's not like a screaming, oh my gosh, this is something brand new that I've never seen. I have to charge a whole bunch of money on it kind of deal.
Yeah.
But if you really need help saving for those things, then cool. Yeah, why not?
I'd only be afraid that if he has trouble saving in the first place, that he might not pay off the entire balance every month, which kills everything. I mean, the 2%. But if he can pay it off every month, then yeah, have that money go into an emergency fund. That's great. Len, thoughts?
I'm with you. You know, those creditors, your report is constantly being updated, right? Because every 30, 45 days, they're sending their credit reports or they're into these bureaus. And it's all staggered throughout the month. So your credit score is constantly moving depending on when your creditors are reporting to the credit bureaus. So if you're worried about that, you know, it's a 30 to 45 day thing. But like Joe said, if you're going to pay that thing off every month, you're not harming your credit utilization at all.
Not long term anyway, unless you're going out for something like 15 days later, maybe.
Yes.
You are. But yeah, we with all the house construction we've had, we've put lots of stuff on our credit cards, and you should see my credit score bounce around. Like in a month, it will bounce like 60 points, huge bounces.
That's all those creditors reporting to the bureau, and then they are, as in real, almost real time, they are adjusting your score. So that's how it works.
Yeah. Paula, anything to add?
Yeah. So I just want to piggyback off of that. So yes, as Len said, the creditors report your utilization to the credit bureaus, but that reporting does not coincide with the statement end date. You know, it happens in an ongoing, continuous sort of way, and it'll happen at least once a month. And so my strategy is that rather than wait until the end of the month and pay everything off on a monthly basis, I'll pay off my credit cards far more frequently than monthly in order to keep that utilization essentially artificially low. So
yeah, but do you really care?
It depends on if I'm going to take out new credit soon or not. So if I know that I'm going to apply for a mortgage like imminently, if I plan to apply for a mortgage in the next 3 months, that's when I get really careful about monitoring my credit score. If I don't plan on applying for a mortgage, then no. You know, if I don't plan on taking out any new loans anytime soon, then no, I don't care.
The reason I ask that is because I feel like there's a lot of people, and this, by the way, Nick, is not, this isn't directly a response to your question, but there's a lot of people out there that ask questions about credit all the time, and not enough people that ask questions about building true wealth. We worry about how credit works, and I'm sure, Nick, you're worried about both of them. So once again, this is not it, Nick. Nick, don't ask questions about credit. Ask lots of questions and know how it works. But most of the time, I try not to care about my credit. Mm-hmm. Like I try not to. Anybody have anything else?
Hey, Joe, real quick. I wanted to just real quick. That's a great point because it seems like people are obsessed with their credit score sometimes, overly obsessed.
Right.
And it's almost unhealthy. You know, you don't get bonus points for anything over 740. You don't. That's it. 740 is the excellent credit. You get eight. It's great. Hey, you want bragging rights to say you have 800 or 840 or 850. But
yeah,
it's it. It's eight, you know. Once you're there, you're there.
It doesn't stop me from introducing myself at parties as 8:15.
Okay.
But I'm 8:15.
I know my, you know, I catch myself just mentally doing it, or the honeybee will do it. We'll say, oh, you know, the credit score just dropped below 800, went to 792 or whatever, you know? You know, it's like, so what? Who cares, you know? It's okay.
Wait, but Len, they've modified the credit score so that now the new high is 850. So the score that's considered excellent is 800 or above.
What?
Yeah. So
when did that happen?
So very good.
I know the
very high. Good is 740 to 799, and excellent is 800 to 850.
Okay, but I bet you they don't. I don't think you get any extra bonus points for eight. Even, okay, maybe they. I know it's been 850 for a long time, but it was 800. It's been 850 for quite a while. But I don't think you get any bonus points for credit beyond 740, but be shocked.
I would disagree there. You know, particularly if you're trying to take out commercial loans, if you're trying to take out investor loans, there are many loans that require excellent credit or that will charge you a premium if you have anything less than excellent credit.
Wow, I'm gonna have to look into that. I'm not sure about that.
Len's just sour grapes because he has an A minus in something.
I'm still mad because I lost a darn Shakespeare thing.
He's still way back like 15 minutes ago. Thanks for the question, Nick. And you know what? Going back to the poverty discussion we had earlier, I do think that understanding credit, especially when you're trying to climb out of poverty, like my goal is to not worry about it. But frankly, when I was worried about where my next meal was going to come from, I had to intimately know my credit score and I had to know how it worked. And I had to know how the system was being played because I felt like the system was being played against me, which is probably why I'm so adamant that I don't want to care anymore. I want nothing to do with it. Thanks to Nick for asking that question. We're going to send Nick some Stacking Benjamins swag for calling in. If you'd like to ask a question of our team, stackingbenjamins.com/voicemail. That's going to do it for today, guys. We'll have our guest of honor go last. Let's have Mr. Penzo go first. Len?
Yes, thank you for not letting me follow Paula. That's always a bad thing for me, especially this week. I got 22 smart money tips everyone can learn by playing doctor. We're playing doctor.
Let's Whoa, play. Hey.
You know that game. You know that old child's
It's a family blog, game. Len.
It's actually, yeah, well, okay. It is, but don't worry. It's a clean story, but it's really entertaining, I think. I took the time to put this together. I thought I was really clever. Stop by LenPenzo.com and see somebody, please. All the work I put into this darn thing. I tried to be as clever as I could. Isn't that clever? Smart money tips by playing doctor. You're going to love it.
For people that can't see him, Len is on his knees right now. Please go visit his site. Please.
All right. Let's hear which Nobel Prize laureate Paula's interviewing next. Over to you, Paula.
Recently on the Afford Anything podcast, we had John Acuff, the author of 7 New York Times bestselling books, and he came on the show to talk about overthinking and how to overcome overthinking so that you don't get trapped in analysis paralysis. Next week on the podcast, we're going to have Gorik Ng. He focuses on career management and workforce development at Harvard Business School, and he talks about the unspoken rules. So what are those rules that you need to know in order to get ahead in your career, in the workplace? And really on the topic of trying to ascend into a socioeconomic status that you were not born into, you know, a lot of what he talks about relates to that because oftentimes there are social norms that you might not be familiar with, but that you are expected to know. And so he talks about how that can be a disadvantage if you didn't come from a culture like or a background where you learned some of these unspoken rules, and how making sure that people understand those unspoken rules is a big part of career success and is a big part of you know, building wealth.
On the Afford Anything podcast.
Yes, on the Afford Anything podcast.
But this little school, Harvard, never heard of it. Maybe up and coming?
Yeah, exactly. It's a, you know, I think it's pronounced Harvard. It might be Harvard?
Harvard. I think that's a cheese.
Harvardi. Yes. Harvardi.
Delicious. Yes. Fantastic. He's a professor at Harvardi.
He's not a professor. He works specifically with career development at Harvard Business School.
He's very cheesy. No.
Cheesy? Oh, yes, because he is Havarti.
Never mind, Paula. We're on totally different. We're done. Jillian, thanks for hanging out with us, Jillian.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad we finally got together. I was telling somebody today, I said, when I go on Facebook, this woman that I've never had a conversation with, Jillian, it always tells me that I have more friends in common with her than anybody else. It's like, you have 162 friends in common with Jillian. I'm like, and I've never talked to Jillian. So I'm glad we finally got to do this. But what's coming up on Everyday Courage?
Everyday Courage this season is about marriage and money and how to communicate about it, how to talk about it, and specifically how to really understand how your childhood experiences and early adult experiences kind of shaped how you respond to money situations. so that you can explain those to your spouse. Because that was probably 90% of me and my husband's fights when we first got married, is us both having big, peculiar reactions to money and not really understanding why we were reacting that way, and definitely not being able to communicate that to the other person.
I saw you spoke recently with our mutual friend, Andy Hill from Marriage, Kids, and Money, about therapy, like about their money fights.
It can be helpful to have someone facilitate those conversations for you.
Sure. And that's Everyday Courage, where finer podcasts are distributed. That's going to do it for today, everybody. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Doug, you've got it from here, my friend. What should we have learned today?
So what should we have learned today? First, take a lesson from our roundtable discussion. Being behind financially is exhausting. Leveraging the people and resources around you might make all the difference to your financial future, while remembering that the past doesn't equal tomorrow. Second, digital banking? Turns out there are lots of great banking features available no matter where you are. You don't have to be locked into the bank in your backyard anymore. But the big lesson? You know, if Shakespeare was alive today, he wouldn't be put in a box to talk like a dude who lived hundreds of years ago. He's original, and so are we. None of that formal talk around these parts anymore. Seriously, if Shakespeare were alive today, you know what he'd be saying? Let me out of this coffin. So good. So good. Hey, Steve, put a little ba-dump bump in there to really make that joke land. You know what I mean? That joke never gets old. But seriously, he'd really want out of that box. To learn more about our guests and for more resources, you can head to our show notes page at stackingbenjamins.com. To hear more from Jillian Johnsrud, just tune into Everyday Courage wherever you listen to podcasts. To see what Len Penzo has to say, just head over to lenpenzo.com. And thanks to Steve Schnall for joining us. You'll learn more about Quantic Bank at quantic.com. That's quontic.com. This show is created by Joe Saul-Sehy, produced by Karen Rapine, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Online, visit us on Twitter at SBenjaminsCast or on our Facebook page. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I just jumped the shark. SB Podcasts may receive payment on the show from sponsors and guests in the form of books, giveaway items, discounts, or other remunerations. That's a big word. There's no way you take advice from these dorks, but like Joe's mom always says, don't take advice from people you don't know. This show is for entertainment purposes only, and before making any financial decisions, consult with a real financial advisor.
Welcome to the after show, Jillian. This is the part of the show that doesn't exist. What happens in this part of the show stays here. You're not allowed to talk about it. And people violate that, by the way, all the time. So if you have to talk about it, then you can call it dessert. But that's but that's it. Just talk about dessert. Paula was talking about unspoken workplace rules. And I mean, I think all of us that have worked in a workplace have either violated an unspoken workplace rule and went, oops, or you have had somebody around you violate those. And I'm not talking about the high-minded stuff that the man from Harvard probably is speaking with Paula about, but I'm talking about like, who never learned the lesson to not steal crap in other people's lunch out of the refrigerator? Like seriously, have you worked in a workplace where that happened? Because I feel like every workplace I worked in, there was one person, and everybody knew who it was. It was just stealing other people's food out of the refrigerator. I don't know. Unspoken.
Was that to anybody? Was that to anybody? Was that to anybody? Because that's happened. That's happened in my work. It's like people have had their lunches completely, their whole lunch stolen out of the refrigerator.
It's amazing. Like,
it is amazing. I mean, you think you're making that up. That is not true. That happens in my workplace. And you wonder, what the heck?
If you bring the worst lunch, yours never gets stolen.
Well, it'll only get stolen once. Yeah. Jillian, it'll get stolen once and it'll never get stolen again.
And then people are like, oh, she's bringing lentils.
That's right.
It's with canned corn. I've never taken that.
That's Jillian.
Lentils and canned corn.
I've tasted her cooking. Forget it.
What other unspoken rules? Or have you guys stepped in one? Have you stepped in an unspoken rule?
Well, I remember when I first entered the workforce, I had no understanding of the politics of who gets copied on an email. There's like a whole political intrigue of like, what does it mean? Who gets the to line versus who gets the CC line? And when is it proper to BCC somebody? And when should someone be included on an email thread versus when should they not be? Like, there's a whole like flow chart to this that
that is a great one, because let me just take it one extra step. It's the reply all versus reply to only the person who sent the original email. We'll have these mass mailings go out on email, and then somebody else will make a, you know, it's a general email about general company business, totally innocuous. It goes out to the whole company, right? Thousands and thousands of people. And then somebody will reply, and they'll reply to all. Oh. And if somebody else replies to all, and it's, and now you've got thousands and thousands.
A chain.
And another one. And then this happens. Then somebody goes replying to all again. Hey, would you stop this? You're spamming up my email box. And then somebody else would reply to all. Yeah, stop it. And then somebody would defend themselves. Reply to all. Hey, that wasn't me. It was an accident. You know, just relax. And before you know it, it's out of control. The reply. Don't hit reply all unless you absolutely have to.
When I was at American Express, the office manager who ran the day-to-day operation and the office head work together all the time on projects. And there was an email that went from the office manager to the head of the office that said, hey, what time do you want to go have dinner tonight? And that was no big deal because Ann and Tony met all the time and were always talking about stuff. That didn't sink them. What sank them was when she did the retrieval.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The recall. Yeah.
The recall
never works.
Yeah, then like 3 minutes later, you get this email recall. And what was an innocuous thing that nobody thought anything about when she went to recall it. And now, by the way, they have been married for many, many years. Like they've seriously been married for 15 years, but they tried to hide that there was something going on. And oops.
Yeah, that's another rule. Don't hit the recall. That just draws attention to yourself.
It totally did. I saw the first email and I'm like, oh, that's no big deal. And 3 minutes later, I'm like, that's a big deal.
I've done that, I think, 3 times, tried to recall. And every time I get the message, but, you know, recall failure, you know, it's like, of course it failed. You know, so nobody's going to accept the recall. They're going to open that email up.
Jillian, any unspoken workplace rules that you can think of that you've either violated or had somebody around you awkwardly step on?
Yeah, but I've worked a lot of weird jobs. I've worked in a lot of weird places. And I used to have this boss that was an alcoholic and would drink like a 24-pack every night and watch us on the camera. But then sometimes we would like...
Wait a minute, would like sit in their office and drink?
Yeah, and just stare at us. Sometimes we'd invite friends over to stare at us while we worked. And I remember sometimes he would come out and like spray soda all over the walls, which we then had to clean up until like midnight. And finally I was like, buddy, this isn't working for me. Like, it's okay if you want to get drunk in your office, but like, you just got to stay there. Like, no more meandering out at 8, 9, 10 p.m. to like wreak havoc on the employees.
Oh, that is so damn creepy. Like, that's just creepy.
Super creepy.
Oh my God.
But it was like their evening hobby, you know, I had some people over, stare at the teenagers while they work. It was like reality TV, except I was the star.
I was going to say, it's either reality TV or a lawsuit waiting to happen. One or the other.
Yeah. Oh. But the new employees like didn't, it took a while to like, here's company culture. Let me just warn you what you're in for. Cause might not be accustomed to this.
That'd be my first day and my last day. Paula, you're looking like you've got one.
Oh no. No,
she's like, I can't beat it. It's like, I'm out.
Well, I hope you got a lot out of today's episode. But one thing that we talked about a little bit today, but we talk about a lot, is you got to have good partners on your team, Stackers. And you know what? Navy Federal Credit Union could be that partner, because becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you earn more and save more. And aren't those two of the big tenets, right? Have a debt strategy, earn more, save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates. Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you can start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. I think that's the coolest certificate. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Considering a big home improvement project? Maybe you want to consolidate debt. Well, as you're putting your plan together, you want to also have a debt strategy, right? You could borrow up to 100% of your home's equity with a fixed rate home equity loan with zero closing cost, or easily borrow as you go with a home equity line of credit. Don't get in over your head with debt. Make sure you have a great strategy and then take out debt as you need it. And Navy Federal's options certainly give you the flexibility to help you make life's big expenses seem more manageable. To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, our members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, equal housing lender, membership required, terms and conditions apply, loan subject to approval.